I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Embattled CIA Director George Tenet resigned today after serving under both Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. The president announced Tenet's resignation this morning before leaving for Europe.
George Tenet is the kind of public service servant you like to work with. He's strong. He's resolute. He served his nation as the director for 7 years.
Well, joining us on the line now is Ronald Kessler, longtime CIA watcher and author of the book Inside the CIA. Hello, and tell us, first of all, did Tenet jump or was he pushed?
I think he jumped. His son is starting college, and his wife, Stephanie, has been after him for some time about the incredible demands that his job entails. And I think he picked a time when it was sort of quiet. There wasn't quite as much criticism of him as usual. You could tell from the pained expression on Bush's face that he really will miss him and that resignation for personal reasons was genuine.
Although some have suggested that someone in that kind of sensitive position doesn't leave during an election year unless the president wants him to step down.
Well, there was an agreement that cabinet officers would either leave sometime earlier or stay until after the election, but that did not apply to Tenet. He's not a cabinet officer, and of course, you know, he's not in jail. He can do what he wants, and he's been in that job 7 years. It's just unbelievably demanding, so I think it's pretty amazing that he stayed that long to begin with.
Well, speaking of timing, as you know, only yesterday there were charges that surfaced against Ahmed Chalabi that he had passed U.S. intelligence on to Iran. Chalabi said it was a smear campaign by the CIA. Do you see any connection between those events? In other words, Tenet was leaving and wanted to take Chalabi down before he went.
No, you know, on any given week, there's some kind of allegation involving the CIA. So in this case, the CIA was on the right side. The CIA has been against Chalabi from the beginning, and rightly so. Chalabi was simply untrustworthy. In my book, The CIA at War, I went into some of the manipulations that he engaged in way back, trying to sort of parlay play off different U.S. agencies against each other to try to bring down Saddam with a totally foolish plot that never would have worked. In this case, I think the CIA was on the right side.
And, of course, there's that memorable picture of him sitting behind Secretary Powell at the U.N. last year as if to say, well, we know more than we can tell you about those weapons of mass destruction. Do you think Tenet felt personally burned by some of the agency's flawed intelligence gathering that led up to the war?
Sure. But also keep in mind that the Iraqi generals themselves thought that Saddam had weapons and that they were supposed to use them. They were supposed to use chemical weapons. So when you have that kind of belief, it's awfully hard to get behind it. And what is important to Tenet is not what appears in the papers, but what George Bush thinks. And Bush really likes him. You can tell, again, from the expression when he announced the resignation. Bush meets with him every single morning, except Sundays usually, as opposed to Clinton, who almost never met with his CIA director. And he knows what the CIA has been doing. A lot of it, you know, never comes out, although we saw some hint of that when we heard that there was interception of Iran's communications. A lot of times that requires not only the NSA, but also CIA people who break into embassies overseas to steal codes. And I suspect that the CIA could take credit for that as well.
And just in the few seconds we have left, his deputy's now been named acting CIA director. What can you tell us about him?
McLaughlin is sort of like a college professor. He's avuncular. He's very thoughtful. He is low pressure. Actually, the day-to-day operations of the CIA are run by Buzzy Krongard, who's the executive director. He's a former head of an investment banking firm. He's a black belt in karate, very colorful figure. Mm-hmm. He sort of keeps the trains running on time. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, nothing's really going to change.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ronald Kessler is the author of the book Inside the CIA.
The U.S. Army is telling soldiers, don't make long-range plans. Invoking a policy called stop-loss orders, the Army has notified thousands of troops scheduled to leave the military that they must stay if their units are in Iraq or Afghanistan. Critics of the move say it amounts to an involuntary draft and proves that troop ranks are dangerously thin. But at least one high-ranking officer says the order is just a temporary measure until major restructuring of the military can take place. Esther Schrader is Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Esther, what is this stop-loss order?
What it means is that people whose contracts with the military end on a date before they were going to get home can't get out of the military. It prevents active duty soldiers and reservists from retiring or leaving their units from the time they're mobilized to go to Iraq or Afghanistan until after their return, even if their volunteer commitments to the military end before then.
Right, 90 days before they deploy and 90 days after they return. What kind of impact will this have on soldiers in the different ways that it will?
There are soldiers who are ending their terms of military service, proud of what they did, happy to have done it, but want to move on with their lives. Many of these are very young people. They want to go to college. They want to start a family. And they don't necessarily want to reenlist. There's a lot of people like that out there that we've spoken to over the last few days who are very concerned about it. This is a kind of move that's very deeply unpopular with the ranks. And the fact that it has been extended to all the units without exception. Obviously, there are some exceptions that commanders can make in certain cases, but the breadth of the order is something that the Army had been trying to avoid, and it shows what kind of a jam they're in.
Yesterday, in an op-ed piece in the New York Times, Andrew Exum, who's a former Army captain, called this stop-loss policy a gross breach of contract, a thinly disguised draft. Why is it thought that the military is doing it?
The military explains it very differently, and I put that question to General Hagenbeck, who's the Army's chief of personnel and who announced the order yesterday. He said, it's not a breach of faith at all. This is the Army. These are soldiers. This is what we do. He says that the reason that they're doing it is not because they're short of troops in Iraq, but rather because they need to build a more cohesive force. They need units to move together, train together, deploy together, and fight together in a way that they have not been when people rotate in and out on an individual basis.
Yeah. Separately, the Army is also reportedly combing through the individual ready reserve. Tell us what that is and why they're doing that.
The individual ready reserve is an odd kind of thing. You can join it if you are experienced in military service and you're leaving military service. It is generally not used except in cases of national emergency. Unlike the reserve or the National Guard, it's almost never called up. The last time it was called up was in the preparations for the Gulf War, but only on a very, very limited basis. It is now being called on because the Army is short of men and women in very specific specialties that they need.
Yeah. It's a pool, we understand, of former soldiers, and so far 618, we understand, have been called back to duty. The combination of this and the stop-loss orders would seem to point to a need for more soldiers.
That's the debate that this country is going to need to have, whether we need more soldiers, whether we need a change in our commitments, whether the fight that's being fought is a fight that would require more sacrifice on the part of the whole country instead of this very limited pool of people who went into the volunteer military largely in times of peace and with different expectations.
Esther Schrader, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Esther Schrader is Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times.
In what could be a precedent-setting lawsuit, the Attorney General of New York is taking on the drug company GlaxoSmithKline, alleging that the maker of the antidepressant Paxil withheld at least one study that showed the drug was at best ineffective and at worst dangerous for children and adolescents. Paxil is not federally approved for pediatric use, which means doctors who prescribe it are doing so on their own. The drug company maintains that it has never promoted the use of Paxil in children, and that while it did not publish the study in question, it never intentionally concealed that information either. Eliot Spitzer is New York's Attorney General. He joins us on the line from New York. Mr. Attorney General, welcome.
Thank you, Gail. Pleasure to be chatting with you.
Well, can you start by telling us a bit about the lawsuit? Certainly, it's not unusual for drug companies to not widely proclaim studies that cast some doubt on their products. So why take on this particular case?
Because the consequences here are so severe. And let me make it clear, it is not my job or any lawyer's job. It is the doctor's job to make the determination about what pharmaceuticals to prescribe for any patient, certainly children who have depression and other issues of this nature. We want to make sure that there is adequate information flow to doctors so doctors can make an informed determination. What we allege in the complaint and what the record will prove is that GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, was disseminating information that alleged that Paxil was both safe and efficacious with respect to adolescent depression, when indeed they had done numerous studies that they did not reveal that proved just the opposite. By only revealing part of the information, they were misleading both patients and doctors.
Well, the drug company says, we weren't trying to conceal anything. We made this information public at a medical convention. Was that enough?
No, it's simply not the case. And what the complaint alleges and what the facts will prove is that they had a very intentional policy of what they called managing information flow to focus on only one of the five studies that was done. That study had somewhat ambiguous results that they claimed demonstrated both efficacious and safe use of the drug. The other four they ignored and did not distribute, did not make available. They had distributed to their sales force a document that I don't have it in front of me, so the words may be marginally off, but a document that claimed that Paxil was both safe and efficacious for adolescent use, when indeed they had possession of studies that proved the other that was not the case. So again, we are not here to argue whether it's a good drug or a bad drug. That's a determination doctors and only doctors should make. We are here to argue, and I'm here to argue, that the information upon which doctors should make that determination has to be made available to them, and that the pharmaceutical company cannot make selective use of information. Withholding information is, under the law, the same thing as misrepresenting, and they did both, and we will argue that, therefore, they should be liable. But I care less about the money than the principle of fair and honest and complete disclosure.
Do you consider this lawsuit to be a precedent setter? In other words, will other suits about other drugs follow?
I think that the principle we're articulating here is one that is critically important, hopefully one that will be adopted. I'm not sure there will be other lawsuits. I know there are other areas which people are looking at that will impact the same issue of adequacy of disclosure. It is an issue that rightly is getting a fair bit of attention now, and there's a healthy debate about the issue, as there should be. We are persuaded we will prevail. Whether it will be precedent-setting, only time will tell.
Mr. Attorney General, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Gail, for taking the time.
Eliot Spitzer is New York's Attorney General.
Just ahead, after last weekend's 25-hour terrorist hostage-taking, some are wondering, how secure is the House of Saud?
And later, a review of Edward Albee's new one-act play.
There's more coming up, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Two men suspected of ties to last weekend's bloody hostage-taking in Saudi Arabia were killed yesterday in a shootout with Saudi police. Also yesterday, a U.S. military officer was injured when gunmen opened fire on vehicles leaving a military housing compound in Riyadh. Since May of last year, there have been dozens of attacks, shootouts, and arrests involving terrorists in the Saudi kingdom, raising the question, how secure is the House of Saud? Joining us first on the line from Singapore is John Bradley, who until recently was managing editor of the Arab News in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. And John, what do you make of this spate of terrorist-related incidents?
Make no mistake about it that Al-Qaeda is now calling the shots in Saudi Arabia. They're the ones who are setting the agenda. Last week, the head of Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia issued a statement calling for his followers to engage in a campaign of urban warfare. They should kidnap foreigners and they should kill them and so on. And within 2 days, one of the cells, sleeping cells in Saudi Arabia, acted on that message. The Saud are responding to events, and it's increasingly obvious that they're trying to deal with a situation which is very, very much out of control. Probably the worst thing they have to deal with is the fact that Al-Qaeda has infiltrated both the Saudi security forces and the National Guard, which answers to the de facto leader, Crown Prince Abdullah.
What makes you say that, John, that that infiltration has happened?
There's very, very clear evidence that this has happened. May the 12th last year, the date of the first attack on a residential compound in Riyadh, involved the implicit cooperation of members of the National Guard. Similarly, the people who attacked the mostly Arab-occupied compound last November did so in a special securities vehicle wearing special security police outfits. And so they too seem to have had some sort of association. Now, in Khobar, in the latest attack as well, it took almost 2 hours for the security forces to respond. The militants managed to go from house to house, engaging locals in a conversation about whether they were Muslims or not. They dragged the body of a Westerner around the streets from their car. Now, how is it that a few months ago, when I lived in Saudi Arabia, I couldn't go to the supermarket without going through three major checkpoints or more, without having the boot of my car open, questioned as to who I was, where I was going? And yet the militants can launch attacks, and it takes more than an hour and a half for them to be engaged. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
John, many others have also said, how could it be that there was a 25-hour hostage-taking in that last attack you spoke of, and that the attackers could get in a car and get lost in the traffic? I mean, wouldn't they be covered with blood? But the government is saying that, in fact, they tailed those men, and that the fugitives then got in touch with men in Mecca who authorities shot and killed yesterday.
Yes.
You know, so Saudi officials are saying that it was all according to plan.
Take everything the Saudi is saying with a pinch of salt at the moment. As I said at the beginning, it's very much al-Qaeda that are calling the shots at the moment.
Well, John Bradley, thank you.
Okay.
John Bradley, former editor of the Arab News in Saudi Arabia. We turn now to Anthony Cordesman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He's just released a draft study of the security situation in Saudi Arabia. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you.
Well, before we get to your study, let's dispense with one question. As you well know, there are a lot of people wondering, after last weekend's attack in Saudi Arabia, how did the gunman get away after a 25-hour siege? There are many who say this couldn't have happened if the security forces weren't in some way compromised or sympathetic. Your thoughts?
Well, it's very easy in an urban environment to have people get away. There are some reports that a deal was made to protect the hostages in return for letting some go. But the fact is, when you're concentrating on the hostages, when your whole operation is geared around protecting people, and you have areas with many exits where people have really looked at all of the possible ways out, it's common, not unusual, to have a few people escape.
We spoke to an energy expert earlier this week who said that oil facilities are extremely hard targets to hit, but then we hear former CIA people like Robert Baer say the exact opposite, that one major facility in particular sits sort of like a ripe plum on the coast. What is your sense of whether or not major facilities will come under attack?
They may well come under attack, but a lot of people are talking who've never been to these facilities, who've never looked at a vulnerability analysis, and are making judgments for which they have no background whatsoever. The fact is that in a country as big as Saudi Arabia, with pipelines, oil facilities, oil equipment all over the country, given links are vulnerable. However, the ability to hit them doesn't really accomplish very much. If you knock out the ability to export 100,000 barrels a day for a couple of days, you may get some sort of panic in the commodity market, but it has no real impact on the oil market as well. There are choke points, and I wouldn't care to identify them over the air, but because they are choke points, they're very dense, and they're relatively easy to protect. And we do know that Saudi Arabia has sharply improved its security since May of last year. So the kingdom is anything but invulnerable. But the idea that it's easy to attack and that somehow you can do major damage is simply unrealistic, and it isn't based on any studies of Saudi vulnerability that have been conducted in the U.S.
To sum up for us, Anthony Cordesman, with all of your charts and graphs and all of the, you know, the information you've been amassing there, do you think that a collapse of the Saudi regime is at all a realistic scenario?
I don't see any chance of that happening in the near term. Mm. The problem is not that there is some intensely fragile structure today, but it is quite clear that the Saudis themselves see that it is absolutely critical that they restructure and diversify their economy, they modernize their society and education system, and above all, they create valid jobs and career opportunities for their young men and women. Crown Prince Abdullah has said that. Virtually every senior member of the royal family in the government has said it. Mm. So the problem is not that there is some intensely fragile structure today.
Mm. Anthony Cordesman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Allegations of sexual assault in the military are rising sharply, up 25% in the past 5 years, according to a new Army task force report that lawmakers are hearing about on Capitol Hill today. The task force has concluded that the Army does not have a clear, comprehensive policy for dealing with the sexual assault of women soldiers. Joining us on the line from Washington, where he's been reporting on how Congress is dealing with this issue, is Miles Moffitt, staff writer for the Denver Post. And Miles, this latest report was ordered by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld after stories about sexual assault appeared in your newspaper. How might these hearings change life for women in the military?
Well, it's clear that the message is loud and clear that policies need to be uniform throughout the services. Right now, it's a pretty scattershot approach to responding to victims. There are majority of military bases and units don't have victim advocates who can react right away to help protect victims. So that's one of the current threads you'll see in legislation as well as this latest report, the notion that there have to be more victim advocates.
And what are congresspeople saying? Do they seem to be surprised by these numbers?
You know, it's clear that Congress is very much aware that the military mishandles sexual assault cases in a variety of ways. And the statistics have been, kind of inconsistent. The Undersecretary, David Chu, has said in recent weeks that the rate of increase is not very high or not even increasing at all. But these new figures show, of course, the biggest service branch, that indeed, cases are on the rise. But, of course, it's a widely unreported crime, so the picture is still pretty blurry.
Well, and your paper reported that dozens of women sought counseling at civilian rape centers after they came home from Iraq. Does that tell us that during combat there are other concerns that seem more pressing, or does it suggest that the military just doesn't have adequate services?
Both. There have not been nurse examiners, forensic kits, counselors available for these women who are in the combat zone.
And does that also answer the question as to why so many cases go unreported?
Well, many of the women want confidential communications with a counselor, a victim advocate. And in the military, you don't have confidentiality protections like you do in the civilian world. These task force reports that are coming out right now acknowledge that, you know, this is a barrier to women stepping forward. But there's also this really deep conflict, because the military, you know, the culture is we have to know everything. And that's the big impediment to ushering in a confidentiality for women.
And making some of these changes would probably cost some money and also perhaps suggest a need for a change in mindset. How receptive does the military seem to be to making these kinds of changes?
You know, it takes lots of public pressure. And over the last decade, red flag after red flag has emerged showing that, you know, the military does not respond to sexual assault as well as civilian agencies. And, you know, although they're passing legislation and insisting on uniform policies, there's been a lack of detail in the legislation. And basically they leave it to the military to fill in the gap. You know, over the next 9 to 12 months, it'll be really interesting to see what happens.
It will indeed. Thank you, Miles.
Thank you.
Miles Moffitt is staff writer for the Denver Post. He spoke with us from Washington. For the big picture on women in the military, we turn now to Francine D'Amico, who teaches political science at Syracuse University. Hi, Francine.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. We've just heard, as you did, about an increase in sexual assault of soldiers, women soldiers. How do you explain those statistics, and is that part of a larger problem?
Well, the problem is, for a woman to report a sexual assault, she has to go to her CO, her commanding officer. And when she does that, typically what happens is that the officer, trying to keep, you know, the cohesion of the unit, trying to keep the morale of the unit up, will suggest that, you know, maybe what happened wasn't so bad. You don't want to ruin a good man's career. You really need to think about, you know, how this is going to affect everybody else, not just you. And the idea that the group comes first is inherent in the military, but it's clear, too, that the pattern of sexual harassment and assault has been endemic in the military. So I think part of this endemic picture of sexual assault is caused by the gender imbalance in the military. Women comprise about 15% of the U.S. military overall. They're only about 10% of the forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they're in a very volatile situation where if somebody in your unit assaults you, you have to go back to that tent and sleep with your rapist in the cot next to you. You know, that kind of situation doesn't make reporting any easier.
Well, and it's also worth noting that in Iraq and Afghanistan, I believe there are about 22 women who have died in the fighting. In fact, there's a story in the New York Times today, very dramatic and poignant, about a female soldier who lost part of her arm. Her left hand was blown off. She was a gunner on a rooftop. So, you know, it's not a matter of women being behind the lines in some sort of safe place. They're on the front lines, too.
And women are not the only military personnel that are subject to sexual assault. I want to make that clear. But they are do have the problem that they are so few in number. They're a minority in whatever unit that they're in. And so the level of, you know, intimidation and psychological coercion of, you know, you're going to fit in, you're going to play along, we need you to be one of us. Mm. That level of coercion is especially powerful.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, whether there's some connection to be made in terms of wanting to fit in, how that plays out in underreporting sexual assaults, and also in the role of women in the prison scandal at Abu Ghraib.
I think in both situations, there is that pressure on the person who is seen as not part of the core group. Not all men in the military don't like women in the military. There's a small but very vocal minority who engage regularly in what I label gender harassment. Women don't belong here. Women can't do this job. Mm-hmm. Women shouldn't be here. And then sexual harassment and sexual assault kind of take that to the next level as a way by the few who think women don't belong to kind of push them further to the margin and many times successfully push them out of the military. And I think that's what the military really needs to address. I think one thing that's positive is that in fact, more women are coming forward with reports.
Francine, thank you.
You're welcome.
Francine D'Amico is assistant professor of political science at Syracuse University and co-editor of the book Gender Camouflage, Women and the U.S. Military.
Still to come, we review the new Edward Albee production. You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
We played a portion of Al Gore's recent spirited speech demanding that members of the Bush administration resign. Some people liked it, some didn't. Rick Fulton writes, Gore's Howard Dean style of pep rally speak is a real turnoff. His delivery was clearly meant to play to his captive audience and did not sound very vice presidential. It really makes one wonder about Gore's maturity and stability.
But listener Craig Sewell says Gore was right. The Bush administration is putting our country at risk. Journalists should hold them to account, not facilitate their spin.
Rob McElver of Voorhees, New Jersey, wrote after our conversation with Wayne Slater, political editor of the Dallas Morning News. Rob writes in part, Slater concluded that because there is, in his opinion, no real difference between John Kerry's position on the war and the multinational approach belatedly adopted by President Bush, that the almighty swing voters will be left with no reason to fire the president. Well, what about the administration's ideological rigidity that got us into this chaotic and unnecessary war in the first place? What about the billions in corporate welfare and private tax windfalls? Certainly Iraq is bad enough, but this election is about a lot more than Iraq.
And after several Democratic attorneys general called for an investigation into higher gas prices, we spoke with Sterling Burnett of the National Center for Policy Analysis, which prompted Wendy Heller of Kingston, New Hampshire, to write, I was appalled at his obvious and unchallenged pro-Bush stance. His assumption that the AGs who are asking for an investigation are merely attempting to embarrass the president should have been challenged. His statement that he is not upset that the refineries are making more profits is all well and good, but does not address the position of the consumer or the possible antitrust violations of the refineries conspiring to raise prices.
And this update, we reported on the New York Times' recent article in which editors said the paper hadn't been as skeptical or vigilant as it should have been in early reporting on the possibility of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Well, Howell Raines, who was editor at the time the paper was reporting on WMDs, has since written a defense of Times reporters like Judith Miller and says he does not agree that problems in the Times WMD stories came about because editors felt pressured to get scoops into the paper before checking facts.
And finally, Laura Bauman of Watertown, Massachusetts, sent us a brava for our interview with mystery writer and opera lover Donna Leon, but also wanted to know the name of the CD of Handel arias produced by Ms. Leon. It was La Maga Abbandonata, or The Abandoned Sorceress.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
This note, if you have just tuned in, citing personal reasons, George Tenet has resigned his job as director of the CIA. President Bush accepted his resignation and described Tenet as a strong and able leader. Tenet has been under fire for months. This past May, the panel investigating the September 11th attacks criticized the CIA for failing to fully appreciate the threat posed by al-Qaeda. Tenet was also criticized about intelligence on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, intelligence that was cited as one of the reasons for the war. In a speech in February, Tenet defended his agency's reporting and his agents.
They never said there was an imminent threat. Rather, they painted an objective assessment for our policymakers of a brutal dictator who was continuing his efforts to deceive and build programs that might constantly surprise us and threaten our interests.
George Tenet will remain on his job until mid-July. His deputy, John McLaughlin, will then lead the agency until a successor is found.
Earlier this week, we spoke with multiple Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Edward Albee. His new work, a one-act companion piece for the 1959 groundbreaking play The Zoo Story, was about to open at the Hartford Stage in Connecticut.
I'm always afraid on opening night the sets will fall down or the audience will come in late and start talking and yelling, and I hate opening nights for that reason.
Well, Here and Now theater critic Bill Marks has seen Albee's new work. It's called Peter and Jerry. It includes the new one act called Home Life and the slightly updated Zoo Story. And Bill Marks joins us now for a review and a reminder of why we care so much about what Edward Albee thinks or writes. And Bill, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, you know, I spoke, as you know, to Edward Albee, which was in parts at times like being in one of his plays, sort of Virginia Woolf before, you know, too many cocktails are consumed. He can be prickly.
He can be very prickly. I mean, he's been both very celebrated on Broadway and he's also been reviled on Broadway. He's been loved by the critics and he's been hated by the critics. And I think he feels now, coming back to success late in his career, that he has nothing to lose.
Yeah, right.
So
and
why should he suffer fools gladly?
Thank you, Bill. Well,
didn't call you a fool, Robin. It's a phrase.
But he also has changed the way we look at theater. Tell us a little bit about that. Remind us of his biography.
Well, I mean, Edward Albee revolutionized American theater in the late 50s, early 60s. He was part of the off-Broadway scene, which in a sense changed the terrain of theater by bringing in a kind of language and a kind of characters that were edgy. He did bring in sort of marginal characters into the American stage, and that just riled everybody up. And also, he made a transition from off-Broadway to Broadway, so plays like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, A Delicate Balance, Tiny Alice, all played on Broadway. So he was seen as part of this sort of unconventional playwriting suddenly coming into the mainstream.
He was the golden boy and embraced. And then, you know, he had a fallow period with the critics, but
Well, he had a fallow period on Broadway, too. I believe his last Broadway show might have been The Woman from Dubuque or maybe All Over. And after that, let's say the early 70s, he no longer appeared on Broadway because a number of those plays in the middle period really aren't all that good in my estimation, although I'm sure Mr. Albee would disagree. But later on, in the late 80s and early 90s with Three Tall Women, which won a Pulitzer Prize, which played on Broadway, he's now displayed an enormous resilience as a playwright. And each play that he's written in the 90s announced with this new play show a real vitality and talent.
Well, let's talk about the new play, Home Life. He says, do not refer to it as a prequel. He hates that word. What would you call it?
What I would say is that it is, in a sense, a companion piece which deepens a play that, if you know American theater well, you know that The Zoo Story is a one act which is one of his most famous plays, and it's one of his most produced plays.
And just in case you have forgotten, it's the story of the two men who meet on a park bench. It's all set around a park bench in Central Park.
It's all set on a park bench, and a publisher, a very sort of, not mousy, but very square sort of fellow named Peter is sitting, reading a book, trying to get some work done, and a guy called Jerry, sort of scruffy, unruly, and a bit difficult, begins a conversation. Conversation takes him through a journey in which Peter becomes involved in things that he had never dreamed he would become involved in. And in a way, that's sort of Albee's modus operandi, you know, to take people who see themselves as living a very sort of safe, secure life, suddenly being sucked into the sort of emotional, psychological, metaphysical chaos around us.
You're a very sweet man, and you're possessed of a truly enviable innocence. But good old Mom and good old Pop are dead. You know, I'm broken up about it, too. I mean, really. But that particular vaudeville act is playing the cloud circuit now, so I don't see how I can look at them all neat and framed.
A scene from the Hartford stage production of The Zoo Story. And it's hard, we have to place ourselves in that time, Bill. This was before Oprah. You didn't walk up to people on park benches and spill the beans.
Well, it also gives the play a certain amount of credibility. I mean, Albee has done very little updating. He's made the publisher, who I think made about $18,000 in 1960, now is making $200,000, which I think is a little inflated, but okay. And he also includes a reference to Stephen King. But the language still holds up really well in this play.
Well, and so if it holds up, why the need for the nude piece? Edward Albee told us that, you know, when he was commissioned to do this, he always felt like there was more to learn about Peter.
I think that's absolutely right. Peter is a bit of a cipher, and I think that when Albee was in his 20s writing this play, he simply saw Peter as a nice, sweet square, and would give the audience gratification by seeing the square get upset. I think he now, after all these years, realizes that there's probably a lot more to Peter than the play's willing to give that character credit for, and by writing Home Life, we see that Peter has to deal with chaos at home because his wife Anne has some very uncomfortable questions to ask him about their lives together. I mean, what I liked about this play, Home Life, is that Peter is not made fun of. In fact, we see his limitations. We see that he's a bit conventional. He's afraid. He likes living a smooth, happy life. But he's aware of the chaotic, difficult aspects of life. And he realizes that if you hold too close to security, you do miss a lot of the more exciting things in life. So in that way, when Peter finally sees Jerry in the park, there's a nice dramatic arc. I mean, it's been a bad day for Peter, essentially. He has his wife essentially asking him, talking to him about his sex life, indicating, well, you're a great lover, but there's a certain amount of anger, a certain amount of animality missing in the way you make love. And then suddenly here he is with Jerry, again, assaulting his way of life.
Well, let's hear a little of Edward Albee's Home Life.
Before I married you, my mother said to me, why ever would you want to marry a man who publishes textbooks?
She did not.
Well, she could have, and maybe she did. Why ever would you want to marry a man who publishes textbooks? Gee, Ma, I don't know. Seems like fun.
Thought your family liked me.
They do. He's a good, solid man, Dad said.
A scene from Home Life, now part of the two-act play called Peter and Jerry, being performed at the Hartford Stage in Connecticut. So, Bill Marks, what did you think to Edward Albee's new companion piece for The Zoo Story?
I thought quite a bit of it. I mean, I don't think it will stand on its own like The Zoo Story, which has been performed on its own for years, is on a program of, let's say, one-act plays. But I think as an introduction, as a, sort of a preface to The Zoo Story, it's really wonderful. Because it gives Peter a certain complexity and multidimension that isn't present in The Zoo Story.
Many were worried that Edward Albee was taking a risk messing with a classic, but it sounds as if it was well worth his attempt.
Well, he hasn't really messed with The Zoo Story. He made a few minor, he's playing it safe. He's not rewriting Zoo Story, but what he's done is that he's added to Zoo Story, deepening its impact.
Bill Marks, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now theater critic Bill Marks. For more information on Edward Albee and to hear an interview with the playwright we aired earlier this week, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. Thank you.
coming straight from now. Rule is the rebirth for cool. Chopping records like a power tool. Showering with jewels. Fool's paradise. I had a slice and didn't like the taste. I'm into drums and bass rumbling.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.